Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Delighted to have you all here on this rainy day. I'm Charlie Ebinger. I'm the director of the Energy Security Initiative Program at Brookings, and on behalf of the ESI program and our colleagues in Metropolitan Policy, particularly the director, Rob Fuentes, we are delighted to have you here today. And we're particularly delighted to have Commissioner Wellinghoff to talk about this very vital subject confronting the nation. I think we all know that if we don't move forward and building a new national electricity grid and the smart grid component of that, that we will not have be able to harness the great potential this country has to utilize our renewable energy resources, particularly our vast wind and solar resources, and move ourselves away from a fossil fuel-driven economy to economy of the 21st century and beyond. I am delighted to have Chairman Wellinghoff here today. For those of you that have not had the privilege of meeting the chairman, I can think of no one better suited to have been appointed to this high-level position by the president. He is an energy law specialist with more than 30 years working in the field. Before joining FERC, he was in private practice and focused exclusively on energy matters related to renewable energy, energy efficiency, and distributed generation. The chairman was the primary author of Nevada's Renewable Portfolio Standards Act, which has been recognized as one of the two states to receive a star rating by the Union of Concerned Scientists. Anyone who can get the Union of Concerned Scientists to endorse you is doing okay. In addition, he has worked with clients to develop renewable portfolio standards in six other states, and the chairman is considered an expert on the state renewable portfolio process, and he has lectured extensively in various law schools and other forums across the United States. I will not take more time. You have his full biography in your program, but it's indeed a privilege to introduce Chairman Wellinghoff.
Thank you, Charlie, and I want to thank Brookings for inviting me here today to this forum, an important topic that we all need to discuss. And I'm also glad that we're starting to populate the front row here. I was afraid I was back in academia. Nobody wanted to sit in the front seat, so I'm glad we've got that going. Well, were any of you at my talk yesterday at the American University Law School? That's good, because I'm going to basically say the same thing. I'm more or less going to go through the same thing. It was a good group. It was primarily the ABA Renewable Energy Committee, and about 60 of them and about 20 law students. And actually, it was a very good discussion. So it was a good warm-up for today, what I want to go through. What we want to talk about is transmission and the distribution level side you're going to talk about later on today. The next topic you've got is governance of the transmission system and how that's going to work. And I'm going to talk about that in some detail from my perspective. But let's talk about where we are. And I'm just going to throw up some slides, and the slides are not necessarily going to follow what I'm going to talk about. I'm just going to give you some slides, some background. This particular slide is one that was prepared by Black and Veatch for the Western Governors. The Western Governors is doing an analysis of the Western interconnect of transmission. And it's interesting that we now finally have people looking at the Eastern and Western interconnect. But if we look overall at the transmission system in this country, we have over 300 individual transmission owners. We have over 125, and actually my people at FERC tell me we have 126 balancing authorities. That means that we have 126 different entities who have responsibility over some portion of that transmission system that have to balance it and keep it in frequency balance precisely to ensure that the lights stay on within that particular balancing authority. But we have 126 of them. We have over 160,000 miles of transmission lines that are over 230 kV. Fairly high voltage lines, but less than 3,000 miles of lines that are over 500 kV. And that's a lot of what I'm going to talk about today, is the fact that I do believe we need to look at some of these higher voltage lines, or we need to look at some other way for more deliverability, because we're actually needing to look at a new paradigm in this country with respect to transmission. I'll explain that in a moment, why. Since 2001, only 3,000 miles of transmission lines at 230 kV or above have been put into a service, and only 682 miles of transmission line above 345 kV have been put into service. And only 650 miles of that 3,000 miles that I said that were put into service over 230 kV since 2001 have crossed state lines. So most of these higher voltage lines have actually been put in place in service just simply within a single state. And we can look at all of that with respect to transmission and contrast to the fact that since 2001, over 13,000 miles of interstate gas, natural gas pipelines have been put into place. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. So if we look at this system with so many owners, so many control areas, so many low-voltage lines, and so little of a backbone throughout the entire system, I think we can say we have somewhat of a balkanized system. I think we have a system that is outmoded in ways physically, financially, and legally. And I think it's something that we need to consider. We need to consider, why does it matter? Well, the original purpose of the transmission system in this country was much different than I think what our purpose needs to be in the future. The original purpose of the transmission system was primarily for delivering energy from fairly local centralized generation that was put in place by either municipal entities or co-ops or vertically integrated investor-owned utilities to serve their own loads, usually from their own generation, in a very local area. And then there were some modest exchanges between areas, between utilities for balancing and for economic purposes. That's changing. It's changing substantially because a number of national policies and international policies are requiring us to look at something different. Number one, we have an imperative to reduce carbon. Number two, we have an imperative to maintain security. Number three, we have an imperative to ensure the economic viability of this country. If we look at those three imperatives, we need to look at a different transmission system, because I believe we need to do something that can start to develop the vast renewable resources that are in this country that can start to provide and help us provide solutions to these policy issues of economics, of security, and of carbon. If we look at the resources that we have in this country, renewable, we have probably over 350 gigawatts or more of wind in the Midwest that's developable. We may have more than 200 gigawatts just off the Atlantic coast of wind that's developable. In fact, Secretary Salazar has indicated that there may be as much as 800 gigawatts of wind just off the Atlantic coast that is economically developable. There's probably more than 200 gigawatts of wind in the West, in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, that is developable for the Western United States. There may be as much as 1,000 gigawatts of solar energy in the Southwest that could be developed and delivered to Western loads. There's over 50 gigawatts of geothermal energy, conventional geothermal, in the West that can be developed. And above and on top of that, there's probably over 100 gigawatts of unconventional geopressure geothermal in areas like Texas and Louisiana, where we've drilled deep gas and oil wells, and one of the byproducts of that drilling is a lot of hot water that they don't know what to do with, but now is, in fact, potentially economically viable to turn into electricity through a Rankine-cycle process that we use for low-temperature geothermal. And there's also, in addition to this, probably over 100 gigawatts of hydrokinetic energy in streams and rivers and in the oceans adjacent to our coasts. So if we put all that together, it's a huge resource. It's a resource that can help us with those three issues of economics, reliability of carbon, and can ultimately look to directing us to a point where we can get out of the problems we're in. But none of it can be done without transmission. Transmission is ultimately the key. In fact, quoting Bennett Johnson, transmission is the Achilles heel of renewables. If we cannot put the transmission in place, we cannot deliver it to loads, and so we have to somehow look at the fundamentals of what's necessary to make that transmission transformed into a system that ultimately can provide deliverability, marketability of these renewable resources. So what do we need to do to look at those fundamentals? Well, we need to look at three things: planning, siting, and cost allocation. So let's start with the first of those, planning. I was the author of a statute in 1983 in Nevada. At that time, we called it the Least Cost Utility Planning Act, and since then, those types of statutes have been referred to as Integrated Resource Planning Acts or Integrated Resource Planning, which a number of states engaged in. In fact, from the Nevada statute, there were about 17 other states that looked at variants of that statute and put similar statutes into place and started engaging in this integrated resource planning. Integrated resource planning is basically requiring utilities to look at long-term load forecasts and the requirements of their load and ultimately determining how they're going to meet that load in the most reliable, least cost way for their customers. And it's something that's really very fundamental to the utility process. Part of that is, of course, transmission planning, as well as looking at the resources both on the demand and the supply side that are going to meet your loads. It's something that sort of fell into disfavor in the late 1990s when we started to look at deregulation or look at restructuring and look at going to markets, and a number of states moved away from integrated resource planning. It's now starting to come back into favor. And I personally believe that integrated resource planning can be consistent with and compatible with markets, because I think electric markets are very important to all that we're talking about, to making these renewables viable, to making the smart grid viable, to improving the grid. I think we're going to have viable wholesale electric markets in this country. And I think that integrated planning, in fact, can be compatible with a market structure. And we're seeing that in the RTOs. The regional transmission organizations, in fact, are engaging in transmission planning, and they're looking from that beyond transmission planning to extend into the issues of supply and demand. In fact, FERC, in our recent Order 890, which was the upgrade of Order 888, directed transmission owners and operators to engage in regional planning that looks at not only the transmission but looks at supply and demand in a comparable way. So it does start to bring together what effectively is sort of an integrated planning process. FERC is currently holding a number of workshops on Order 890 and the planning aspects of Order 890. We just had one yesterday in Atlanta. There was one last week in Phoenix, and there'll be one, I believe, next week in Philadelphia. So we're moving in that direction. But with respect to renewables, I believe we need to look at planning even on a wider basis. I believe we need to look at planning on a integrated interconnect basis, the Eastern Interconnect, the Western Interconnect, and then, of course, there's Texas, which is interconnect into itself. But the two interconnects, and we have the Western one up here, need to be looked at in an integrated basis because we have renewables in remote areas, and that's, again, the difference. We had these central plants that were located relatively close to loads, and now we have instead resources that are location constrained and remote. So somehow we have to be able to plan to develop them in a robust way so we don't strand them behind transmission lines that are too small to deliver the full amount of the resources there and deliver it to the load centers. And for this map, for example, most of the resources are in the Montana-Wyoming area and also eastern New Mexico area, and the load centers are mostly on the West Coast. So to deliver these, we have to have some type of a planning construct that will help us determine how to move these resources to loads. The Western governors are starting to do that, so we do have an entity in the West doing that. In the East, and let's look at our full map here of our planning system. In the East, and this is going to go for a while, and you'll see a number of things come through here, you have a group that has formed with the RTOs, with a number of investor-owned and other utilities that are coming together looking at forming a formal organization. In fact, they have applied to DOE, and you may hear more about that later from Larry Mansueti, for a grant under the stimulus money to do planning in the Eastern Interconnect. And that planning, I think, is essential as well. And so ultimately, we need to look at planning on both an Eastern and Western perspective. So we need to do it, one for deliverability for these resources, for the renewable resources. We need to do it, two, for reliability. And what you see here is a scenario that my reliability people have put together of delivering more and more wind from the Midwest and offshore Atlantic to the load centers. And what happens is we deliver more and more of that variable resource to load center areas without building up the grid, without strengthening it, without ensuring that we can maintain frequency, and by maintaining frequency, thus maintain reliability. The problem, if we do that, we believe, FERC believes, is the creation of stress throughout the grid. Now, we don't believe that this is something that can't be overcome. And in fact, we're currently engaged in a study now to look at the effects of variable resources on the grid, both in the Eastern and Western interconnects. This study should be done sometime in March or April. And what we're going to do is look at putting increasing amounts of variable resources into each one of those interconnects and ultimately see what that increased amount of resource will do with respect to maintaining the frequency on the grid and determine where the limits are. And then based upon those limits, we're going to look at what are the solutions to overcoming those problems, because we think there are cost-effective solutions to overcoming the problems of integrating in high levels of renewables into the grid. We believe that's true. But the place to start is looking at the study as to where the problems are, and nobody has done that study yet. So this will be a first-time study, as I understand it. So from that, I firmly believe we do need interconnect-wide planning. How we get that done, I'll talk about that at the end of this. Let's talk about our second topic area, and that's siting. And here I want to talk a little bit about pipes and wires. Let's talk about the natural gas system and how we site natural gas pipelines versus how we site transmission lines. Natural gas pipelines are sited by FERC. As I mentioned to you, over 13,000 miles of natural gas pipelines have been sited, certificated and sited since 2000-2001. It's, I think, a very effective process, and we have a robust wholesale gas market in this country, largely due to the fact that we have great deliverability with respect to gas throughout the entire country, because we have a very robust delivery system, that transmission system. FERC was given that authority in the 1935 Gas Act to have that siting authority. We weren't given the authority, however, over siting transmission lines. That largely falls to the states. In some instances, the states actually give it to the counties as well. So it depends, but it's largely the states. There's two instances where FERC does have some limited transmission siting authority. One is in the 2005 Energy Policy Act. We were given authority under the National Electric Interest Corridor section of that act, where DOE can designate a congested corridor, a congestion in a corridor, and by designating that corridor, then developers who may develop transmission lines in that corridor, if they go to a state and, in fact, cannot get that particular line sited through that state process, they have potential backstop coming to FERC. There's backstop authority where they can come to FERC and get that line sited. The other area where FERC has a siting authority is with respect to the Hydro Act, Section 1 of the Federal Power Act. Any hydroelectric facility, the line coming off of that facility that interconnects into the main transmission line is a line that is sited by FERC. And when I say sited by FERC, it means that there is eminent domain authority to site that line ultimately. So hydro facilities, fortunately, are defined rather broad, or have been interpreted rather broad in the Act, which includes a traditional dam impoundment hydro facility. It could be a hydrokinetic facility, which would be an in-river or offshore facility, or it even could be a pump storage facility. Even a pump storage facility is considered to be a hydro facility, and as such, the transmission line from a pump storage facility would be one that would be under FERC's jurisdiction for siting. But beyond that, it is entirely up to the states. So let's look at, you know, back in 1935, why did Congress, you know, decide to give authority on one hand to the FERC and the federal government to site natural gas pipelines, and gave no authority to the federal government or allowed the states to retain the authority, in essence, to do so for transmission lines? Well, again, it was the nature of what was the problem? What was the issue they're facing the country? At that time, we had tremendous amounts of natural gas that needed to be developed in Texas and Louisiana and throughout the Southeast, and it needed to be delivered to loads. It was remote, location-constrained resource that had to be delivered to a load. The loads in the Northeast primarily, or in the West, West Coast. And so we had to have pipelines sited, and that gas had to be moved to places where it could be used. So it made sense. On the other hand, from an electric standpoint, you didn't have location-constrained resources of electricity that had to be moved to loads, because you could, in fact, site your generators fairly close, a fossil fuel gas plant or coal plant or whatever it may be, relatively, or an oil plant. At that time, there were many oil plants as well, could be sited relatively close to where the load was by the local utility, and there didn't need to be this large system. Today, as I've indicated, we have a much different situation. We have location-constrained resources, all those renewable resources that I enumerated, and those do need to be moved to loads. That generation needs to be moved to loads. So I believe we have the situation today that calls for some level of consideration of broader federal siting authority, and I'll talk about exactly what level I believe is appropriate when we get through the last item, and that's cost allocation. With respect to interstate lines, the FERC does decide upon cost allocation, interstate transmission lines under our jurisdiction, but to date, those cost allocation decisions have been largely for either a transmission owner and their footprint, their control area, or for beyond that, an RTO within a regional transmission operator's boundaries, which can be as big as the state of California, it can be as big as New England, or with the case of Midwest ISO, goes from Minnesota to Kansas and into the Dakotas and over to Montana, the little parts of Montana. So it can be a fairly large area, but to date, FERC has yet to actually do cost allocation across regions, across multiple RTOs, across states where there are transmission owners throughout the West, for example. It's been very localized. So the question is, if we're going to do planning across an interconnect, how do we do cost allocation across an interconnect? Legally, I think FERC has the authority to do it across the entire interconnect, but I think politically it would be very useful to have some support to ensure that that's something that Congress thinks is the right thing to do, the states think is the right thing to do, and it's something that can be agreed upon generally. So I'll talk about in a minute how to do that. But the issues in cost allocation, of course, come down to, you know, are you going to socialize the costs? Is it going to be the interstate highway system where, you know, it, in essence, a tax everybody pays, and we're going to decide what this backbone is going to look like, and it's going to be spread to everybody? Or are we going to, in fact, look at beneficiary pays, who are the beneficiaries of the system, and who's going to pay? Let's look at one visualization of a backbone. This was put up by NPR, a National Public Radio, in a story that they did on the grid. And I'm not sure even where they took this grid outline from, but it's just one concept of the yellow lines, or one concept of adding to the grid. And again, it's not a concept that FERC endorses or I necessarily endorse. It's just for discussion purposes. There's many, 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 many other concepts. But the question is, again, who's going to pay for this? If you take a line from North Dakota, for example, you can see the line starting up in North Dakota that's going to go all the way, you know, to functionally Boston, and it goes through Ohio. Should Ohio pay for parts of that line? If most of the wind is being delivered to the Northeast, you know, that's a question that somebody is going to have to answer. I'm not sure FERC is the appropriate one to answer that, but again, if we're going to build this system, somebody has to decide who pays and who pays for the specific discrete systems. And let me interject here a minute, because I've got something on this slide that I think is kind of interesting, is the smart grid parts of it. Let's talk about some interesting little upgrades. I've had somebody come into my office recently proposing a 3-ring DC bus to be put in this area that I've just highlighted in northeastern New Mexico, that in essence would connect WEC, Western interconnection, with Texas, ERCOT, with SPP, would connect all three together. None of those three entities have any incentive, per se, to put this particular piece of equipment in, because it's no particular advantage to any one of them, but it's a tremendous social advantage to the entire area, because from a market standpoint, it would provide great deliverability for West Texas wind, for example, for wind from Oklahoma, from wind from eastern New Mexico, all of which is very robust and very developable to all these different areas, to be able to have multiple markets. So, you know, I've got a third-party entrepreneur coming into me saying, you know, how do we get this thing built? Who's going to pay for it? And how does it get put in place? These are the kind of questions that we have to start to answer, because there are these kinds of ideas that ultimately can make our entire system much smarter, much more efficient, and much more cost-effective for everybody. Here's another idea that walked into my office, and this is a DC backbone down the Atlantic coast that ultimately would connect southern Virginia with New York City. Now, part of the idea of this is to deliver offshore wind somewhere between 6 and 10 gigawatts, 6,000 to 10,000 megawatts of wind to all these areas. Could be delivered into the southeast, could be delivered into the D.C. area, into New Jersey, into New York and New England, ultimately. But the interesting thing about this line is, and they had some very compelling economics that were done by a very respected economic consulting firm in this country, indicating that this line makes sense even if you put no wind on it at all. Just the difference in prices between these areas would pay for the line in 4 or 5 years. But the problem is, you know, how do you get the capital to make this line go? How do you convince investors that this is going to make sense? And how do you get the financial, the regulatory, and the physical problems all worked out in a way that ultimately good ideas like this that will make the grid smarter, will make it more efficient, will make markets work better, will reduce costs for consumers, can get put into place? And so, you know, how do we do all that? Well, I think we do need some expansion of federal authority in planning, siting, and cost allocation. Once that said, let me give you the caveats. I think it should be very limited, number one. Number two, I think states should be, and states and or regions, including the RTOs, should be the first movers. They should be the ones who have the first opportunity to do the planning, the siting, and the cost allocation. Give it to the states, give it to the regions to look at this as their responsibility to do it with a bottom-up review of what they need in their individual areas, but understanding there is this top-down national policy imperative with respect to carbon, with respect to economics, with respect to security that has to be factored in, that they have to consider, and they have to consider that the purpose of their planning is to do the deliverability of these renewables that we're talking about. Ultimately, I think that's, if we can give that charge to the states and the regions, then as we have this Eastern Interconnect Group applying to DOE for the money, we have the Western governors and others who are looking to do it on the Western side, I think that planning can be done there. But at the end of the day, if they don't get the job done, it's got to come somewhere. It's got to come somewhere to say it's got to get done because we have a national imperative, a national policy, a national need to do this. So that's with respect to planning. With respect to siting, again, I think it should go primarily to the states, but let's have a backstop. Let's expand the backstop beyond this narrow national interest corridor that we have now, and let's talk about a national grid plan that will, in fact, provide for these national policies, but the siting can be done at the local level as long as it gets done. It has to get done to make these things work. And finally, cost allocation. Lock them in a room and decide how the cost allocation is going to be done. Again, let the states and the regions and the entities decide it. But at the end of the day, if they come out of the room and say, we can't decide, somebody's got to be there to say, okay, if you can't decide, we're going to decide for you. And it's amazing how that is a great incentive to get people to decide if you tell them that somebody else is going to decide for them. So that's what I think needs to be done. Let me talk a little bit about, and then I'll end up here and we'll have some questions, how we're going to get there. We get there with all these things with legislation. There's legislation up on the Hill right now in a number of areas in this regard. First of all, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with the Waxman-Markey bill that's been passed, and it's now over on the Senate side for consideration. That bill has nothing with respect to siting and cost allocation in it. In planning, it has some aspects in the Western Interconnect, but it has nothing with respect to the Eastern Interconnect. The Senator Bingaman on the Senate side and the Senate Energy Committee has a bill that does have some aspects that talk about planning, siting, and cost allocation. Senator Reid has a bill that has those things in it as well. We have circulated, FERC has circulated a draft document that we have put together based upon some discussions with Congressman Markey, asking us after a hearing to go talk to some people, and we talked to Chuck Gray, and we talked to other regulators, and we talked to the Western governors, and we didn't get a consensus, no surprise. But what we did get is a lot of ideas, and basically what we did is we just put a lot of these ideas into this document, and we gave that document to Markey's people. I think it's got some good ideas in it, and I think it's worth consideration. And then, of course, there's OEA that just recently has come out on the Hill with a transmission proposal. We've got it. I haven't looked at it in any detail. We're actually trying to look at the OEA proposal and compare it to the one that we gave to Markey's staff and see how the two compare. But what I'll leave you with is a final note that I think is a very important one and one that I'm very happy about and proud of, and that's what Senator Reid has said. Senator Reid, from my state, has indicated that there will be no climate bill, no energy bill without a transmission component, without a very, very robust transmission component. So this gives me some hope that we can all come together and determine how we can shape transmission policy for this country to ensure that we can all get where we need to go. Thank you. questions. So we got time for some questions?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yes, sir.
We have two mics going through the room, so if you just would raise your hand, we'll get one to you.
My name is Dmitry Novik. I have two questions for you.
Sure.
Number one, we have information network, internet.
Yes.
To some extent, it's the same principle of network. Smaller number of providers and huge number of customers. So what is parallel you see in this two network? It's number one questions. And number two questions is, as you said, time changed. In 1935, if I remember correctly, it was basic problem was gas pipelines. Can you go a little bit farther about gas pipeline? Because to transmit gas on the long distance, as I see it, it's economically a very bad decision instead to transmit electrical energy. So it's my two questions.
Okay. Let me answer your second one first. I want to say that it is usually correct that it's more economic to have distributed generation, and I think we should not ignore distributed generation. Certainly, it is a resource that I think is very viable. Certainly, with the amount of gas reserves that we have found in this country recently and the deliverability of natural gas, using that natural gas for distributed generation is going to be a good bridge for us, because you can put distributed generation in place that will ultimately reduce your costs and improve your efficiency substantially. Many distributed distributed generators, combined heat and power systems, for example, have efficiencies that exceed 60, 70, 80% versus central station power plants, fossil plants that are going to have efficiencies less than 50%, plus your line losses associated. So you're absolutely correct there. We should try to do everything we can with respect to distributed generation, but I just don't think that's going to be enough. I think we are going to have to develop our location-constrained remote renewable resources, and the only way to use them is to deliver their energy in long lines. And those long lines we have to make as efficient as possible. That's why the smart grid is so important, is ultimately to make it as efficient as possible. But on your first question, I do believe that there is a great analogy between what we're trying to do here and the communication system. I mean, we put in fiber, we put in the long lines, we deregulated the system, broke up AT&T, and did what we needed to do to bring in entrepreneurs into the system. And I think we need to do the same thing for transmission. We need to bring in people who want to develop and make money off of these robust transmission systems, both the lines and the attendant smart grid and strong grid systems, and make sure that ultimately they can get built in some way. So I think there are great analogies between where we've gone with the internet and the communication system and where we ultimately need to go with a new transmission system. Back in the back, we've got one back. Thank you very much, Charles.
Thank you. Scott Bernstein, a member of the City of Chicago's Climate Task Force. Similar question about the role of energy efficiency. And let me just preface this by saying, in the last couple of years, cities and metro areas around the country have aggressively been dealing with one-year goals on climate change. And I think we know what it's going to mean to have to actually reduce emissions by a very aggressive target, by a very aggressive date, which it seems is going to change the demand for energy. I don't think it undercuts your premise that we need to upgrade the grid, but it might change the specification of it somehow, and it seems that FERC has a role to play here that would create a virtuous circle. If it could send the right signals out to the utilities that you regulate on the wholesale and interstate side, it might make it easier for cities to meet those aggressive goals and in turn get a better spec and a better balance overall in the system that emerges. Have you thought about that?
No, you're absolutely right. When we've done more than thought about it, we're actually doing it in the sense that in the RTOs, we're encouraging the regional transmission organizations to incorporate into their tariffs the opportunity for customers to bid in not only demand response, which would be the shifting of loads and the modulation of loads so that they're reduced at times of higher use, but also to be able to bid in energy efficiency. So, for example, now PGM allows energy efficiency to be bid in, and I think their last auction they had like 600 megawatts of energy efficiency bid in. New England allows energy efficiency to be bid into the system as well. So what we're doing is setting up real economic incentives for customers to increase the amount of energy efficiency. And on that, let me just expand a little bit. We need to set up some system in this country that we can break down the fundamental barriers to the installation of more energy efficiency into our system. And those barriers are largely not economic. Well, they're sort of economic in the sense that part of the barriers is the fact that you know, most people and their payback rates and their returns are, you know, a 2 or 3 year period, and we pay for power plants over a 30 year period. And, you know, that discontinuity between how we pay for those supply side resources versus how we pay for those demand side resources is a real huge problem that people have talked about for many, many years, but we have done very little about. We need to somehow put in place loan guarantees or other ways to reduce the costs, the capital costs of putting in what are, in fact, very economic or more economic investments than the next incremental power plant. And that's really hasn't been done on a widespread basis in this country yet, and we really need to figure out how to break through that and do that. And let me give you a very personal example, the FERC building, which is very personal to me. You know, when I moved into that building in August 2006, I looked at the lighting in my office and decided that, you know, it was a 1994 lighting system. That's when the building was built. It was state-of-the-art in 1994, but it needed to be updated. So I brought in a team. We did a review of the lighting system, and we changed it out completely. We got manufacturers to provide to us a state-of-the-art system to upgrade it. The result was, in my office suite on the 11th floor, we've reduced our lighting energy usage in that suite by 50%. I could do it throughout the building. Problem is, I don't own the building. The building's owned by a third party. We have a lease through GSA. I have no incentive under that lease to do anything because I get no advantage from reducing the energy use in the building. I don't even know or understand what the landlord's advantage or incentive would be to do it, and we've had some discussions with them, and it's very vague to me as to whether they would do it or not do it, and we want to move forward with that. I'm not sure how much help we can get from GSA. I've had an offer from DOE to help us, and we're going to try to team with DOE and see if we can do something with FERC's building. But, you know, economically, you know, it makes a lot of sense. The payback is, you know, probably less than 7 years, maybe less than 5 years to do it. Our lease extends through the next 15 years. So certainly, you know, we're going to be there for that period of time. But again, those barriers are there. We've got to figure out how to get those barriers out of the way. The technology's all there. The ability's to do it. We just need to figure out how to reduce the barriers. Next question. Back over here. Yes.
Good morning. I'm Robert Marmet with the Piedmont Environmental Council. In the absence of a strong greenhouse gas controlling legislation or green electrons like Senator Reidsville has, how do you ensure that the new robust grid doesn't simply carry carbon energy and undercut the efforts to develop cost-effective renewable generation or distributed generation or even energy efficiency?
Well, you're going to design it for what you're going to build, and what you're going to build first is the cheapest and fastest things to build. The cheapest and fastest things to build are wind, number one, geothermal, hydrokinetic, two and three. You know, building any new carbon sources is going to take a while, ultimately. And if you're building natural gas sources to replace coal sources, that may be a good thing because you're going to reduce your carbon by half. So I don't see the carbon argument as a big one. I really don't see it as a major issue. Well, they're existing, but they're at very high capacity factors, so you're not increasing the total amount of carbon that's being put out overall. Ultimately, you're not, in other words, taking a coal plant that's only operating at 20%, and all of a sudden it's going to operate at 80% because it's got a new transmission line. That's not happening. Most coal plants, and we did this capacity factor analysis at FERC for this exact purpose, most coal plants are operating right now in excess of 80% capacity factor. So it's not that those coal plants are going to be putting out any more carbon. The amount of carbon they're putting out now is the amount of carbon they're going to continue to put out until they're retired. So I don't see where putting in a robust grid is going to exacerbate or increase the amount of total carbon that we're putting out in this country. And it's only going to reduce it because you're going to be building that grid primarily for those resources that ultimately can be put online quickest. And those that you can be put on quickest and most economically right now is wind.
But it's still with economic dispatch. The coal is going to be dispatched before the wind.
No, not necessarily. In fact, right now, gas is displacing coal. Gas is cheaper than coal, and in many instances, wind is cheaper than coal because it has a tax credit. In fact, wind has been dispatched in this country at zero cost because it, in fact, can still make money because it has an investment tax credit. So that, in fact, is not the case. Sure.
Then you wouldn't be in favor of the kind of green electron requirements that the Reid bill has in it?
I don't think they're necessary. Lady right here.
Good morning, Chairman. Nancy Baggett from the Electric Power Supply Association. Kind of a quick question. Sure. In everything that you've gone through, and we have attended, I haven't personally, but have colleagues who've attended the past two conferences on the 890 regional planning processes. Right. And I think great improvements were made through that order. Each region, I think, is experiencing some issues. They differ. I'm wondering, though, at this point, if you believe there is more that can be done at the FERC level, or really to get to the next steps, you need some sort of federal authority. And I understand there are varying levels of authority being discussed, but that's the only way to get to the next step.
And that's a very good question. We do believe that there needs to be some additional federal authority, both from political and a legal perspective. However, if we don't get that congressional authority, additional congressional authority, FERC will attempt to go the next step to the extent we can, and I believe we do have the authority to expand planning beyond the footprint of an individual transmission owner or even beyond the footprint of an RTO across and through multiple regions. And I think we will definitely explore that if in fact it isn't done specifically in legislation that comes up. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering if there were international models to follow of distributed electricity generation that might be useful as the U.S. is considering this.
Well, my understanding is that Denmark has maybe 35 or more percent of its energy from distributed generation. So there are a number of countries that have much higher levels of distributed generation than we do in this country. And certainly we need to look at those models and see to what extent they can be put in place. But I think we have probably different legal and regulatory structures in this country that do inhibit and cause barriers for things like distributed generation. I mean, we have issues about local distribution franchises that you can't, you know, run a wire across the street. You can't run hot water across the street in some instances, because if you do, you become a utility. Even though you may own the building across the street, you can't, in fact, have a cogen system that serves multiple buildings in an area if you have to go through across public areas. So, you know, these types of things can inhibit us from looking at local cogeneration and combined heat and power and other systems that could be more efficient. And we need to look at those, and those are primarily things that have to be determined on a local and state level. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name's Craig Berry. I was wondering what role or how FERC has worked to incorporate the Canadian and Mexican authorities to help build a more coherent North American energy grid.
Well, we have meetings with both the Canadian and the Mexican authorities to discuss these issues. Certainly with respect to reliability, the Canadians are part of the reliability group that we do our reliability planning and reliability rules with. So we look at it from that standpoint. We haven't done as much as I think we could, though, and I would like to actually have more meetings with both the Mexican authorities and Canadian authorities to see how we can better integrate our needs with respect to the resources they may have to provide us and vice versa, and how we can better integrate transmission systems to do that throughout North America overall. I think it's an excellent suggestion. Yes, sir.
Hugh Haskell from the Institute of Energy and Environmental Research. We've been talking about efficiency at the local, at the user level, but the grid has its efficiency issues as well, and I wonder if you could discuss something about what we might do to improve the transmission efficiency of the grid itself.
Now, I think from the other side of the meter, from distribution system on up to the transmission system all the way to the generators, there's perhaps as much efficiency to be gained as there is on our side of the meter, on the load side, the customer side of the meter, and it's something that I am very interested in. In fact, I had a gentleman from EPRI into my office about 2.5 years ago discussing the fact that he had an initiative going to look at efficiency on the distribution system and how to improve that distribution system, the transformers and switching and data analysis in ways that would upgrade it substantially. And I said to him, well, why aren't you looking at the transmission system? And he said, well, that's a good idea. So he started an initiative, and he just has completed the first part of that initiative where they've had a series of regional workshops throughout the country. I think they had like 10 or 15 of them, and brought in stakeholders to provide ideas of how to upgrade and make the transmission system more efficient. And then we had a kickoff meeting at FERC just 2 or 3 weeks ago of the analysis of all that data, bringing it all together in one place. And from that, they have now developed a number of projects, specific projects that EPRI is going to initiate to start looking at improving efficiency of the transmission system and how that efficiency can actually be put in the field and put in place. So what they're going to do is actually do a demonstration and deployment of some of these advanced technologies out there on the transmission system. So we're working on it. It's something that I'm very aware of and something that I'm extremely interested in. Okay, a repeat question. Right, I actually missed somebody behind you, but go ahead.
Sorry, I have another question. My question is, it's well known that alternative current in the transmission line disappeared some energy as a heat.
Yes.
It's one of the basic problem and basic principle how this distribution system is designed. What about a distribution system by direct current? Because now we have very efficient converter from alternative to direct current and vice versa. So what's the situation right now?
Well, we need to look at DC and how we can better use DC systems. And I really don't want to talk about it at the distribution level. That's actually a very long discussion of, and actually, you know, using DC at loads, I mean, that's a whole discussion. But if we look at the transmission level instead, I had a very interesting idea come into my office just yesterday, for example, on a DC upgrade to a pair of lines in the west at Meade, which Meade is in southern Nevada. And there's a line that goes from Palo Verde, which is a nuclear facility in Arizona, and it goes up to Meade in southern Nevada, and then it goes from there over into Southern California. And these two lines right now are AC. And the idea that this gentleman had was, instead of having those two lines AC, if you put DC, make those lines DC and put converters on them, a converter at each end and a converter at Mead, he had some analysis that he had conducted that indicated that he could upgrade the capacity of those lines by 1,900 megawatts for a cost that was about one-third to one-fourth of the cost of putting in a line that would increase that capacity by that much. So it was a very cost-effective thing to do, but he was having problems convincing a number of entities, owner, because he wasn't, you know, owner-operator of the lines. He had difficulty convincing the entities of, you know, why this would be an advantage to them. So, again, there's a lot of these ideas out there, and part of them entail looking at more DC lines, like the one I showed you off the East Coast. That's a DC line, the backbone that would go up the Atlantic and be a backbone for all, not only delivering offshore wind, but also for helping to deliver price-effective energy throughout the eastern United States. That's a DC line. So, again, DC lines have a great role to play. You can reduce losses with DC lines, although there is technology now with AC lines that also is reducing losses substantially. So you have to look at the cost effectiveness between the two, because we do have largely an AC system, and to get the DC lines in place, you do have to have converters at the end of them, and those converters are relatively expensive. So you have to look at those cost trade-offs, but I would agree with you that we do need to look at DC as an alternative. Right back here, we've got a question behind you.
Hi, my name is Bob Groh. I'm with the Greater Washington Board of Trade. Could you tell me how the NIST standards are coming along for the smart grid? And I guess as part of that, as a follow-up to the question you just answered, is the DC transmission being considered as well? Thanks.
The NIST standards, I believe, are coming along well. I haven't gotten a real recent update in the last couple of weeks, actually, but the commission issued a policy statement recently on those smart grid standards to help direct the NIST process, and I know that FERC and DOE and NIST are all working together. My understanding is that we're going to be getting FERC is responsible for actually promulgating the rules that come out of that standard development process. So we're going to be getting from NIST, I understand, sometime in December, their first group of rules, that, of proposed rules that they believe we should be looking at to promulgate. So my understanding is the process is moving along. It's moving along pretty quickly for a very technical and complicated standards process. And I'm very encouraged by what they're doing. I'm with respect to DC specifically, I'm not sure what NIST is doing in that area regarding the incorporation of DC into a smart grid system and how it may affect or be affected by potential smart grid standards or rules. That I can't tell you. Scott.
Scott Pugh, Homeland Security. What would you like to see us do about the physical and cyber vulnerabilities in the grid that we have today and the grid that we will hope to have someday?
Oh, boy. That's a whole other lecture, Scott. And I need Joe McClellan standing by my side here to help whisper in my ear and give me some help, but I think I can give you some general idea. I think certainly with respect to cyber and physical security, there's no question in my mind, given all the information that I've seen so far, that we need to do something, and we need to do something relatively soon. And I think that there does need to be, you know, some central authority to be able to put in place recommended changes for the grid to establish better cyber and physical security. I know there's been a lot of articles recently about EMF EMP, I guess it is, electromagnetic pulse, which is a physical issue that could upset the grid. So I know the Congress is working on it. I'd like to see some additional authority at FERC, certainly, to be able to work with the utilities to get put in place standards and requirements that would ensure that we are in a more secure place. But, you know, I can't give you a lot of specifics. Anybody else?
Time maybe for one more question.
Yeah, one more question. Or maybe we're out of questions, which could be good, too. We've got one in the back here.
Thanks. On your building problem, I have a discussion later today with the Commissioner of Public Buildings at GSA. I'll be happy to pass that one along.
Please do that.
Yeah. My question was about smart growth and the form of the grid. We're starting to see a drop in vehicle miles traveled and transportation in the U.S. The foreclosure crisis may end up finally forcing a focus. Congress is talking about some legislation to force better development patterns. And if you think about what that means about the shape of your map there, it seems to me that it might be worth thinking about how future urban and metropolitan form may change that map and maybe even put some efficiencies into it. Putting 100 single-family homes out there at an acre each or putting them all in one building makes a huge difference, it seems to me, ultimately, not only on distribution but on transmission. Would FERC be interested in a dialogue on that?
Well, no, absolutely, because I think all those variables are going to have to be put into the mix when whoever these regional entities look at these interconnect-wide planning constructs. They're going to have to, you know, look 10, 20 years in the future, at least, if not farther, to determine what they are planning for and what, you know, they can't plan for something that's not going to be there, you know, when they get there. And so you're absolutely right. If the urban construct is going to change substantially, that we do decide to get more efficient in the way that we plan and design and develop our communities, our residential and commercial communities, then that's going to be a big issue that will impact certainly the distribution system, and also will mitigate more towards a distributed generation as well, but will also have an impact on how the transmission system should look ultimately. I agree with you fully.
I want to thank Commissioner Wellinghoff for taking time to do this.
These issues. Now I realize how much I need to get updated. I teach a course on this subject at Johns Hopkins. We can get you over there sometime.
That'd be great.
Thank you, sir.
If we could get the first panel to come up, and we'll get you mic'd. And while that's happening, I'd just like to make one small addition to the program. At the end of our first panel, David Girard, who's here today from the Rockefeller Foundation, has asked for just a few minutes to explain a new initiative the foundation has underway on many of these same questions, and we are delighted to give him an opportunity to take 5 minutes and tell you more about that. Just also on mechanics, after our break following this panel, Rob Fuentes is going to take over moderation the chair. I want to apologize to all of you because I unfortunately have a double commitment today, so I'm going to have to leave. But just want to thank you all very much for coming to our session, and Rob will ably take over the second session later today. Our format on the panel is going to be a little different than often the way we do things at Brookings, where we have kind of a formal statement from each of the panelists. We're trying to avoid that today in the interest of a more stimulative debate. So what's going to happen is I, as the moderator, am going to pose a question to a separate question to each of the panelists. After that, panelist kind of takes off and leads remarks in answering the question posed. We'll then present an opportunity to the rest of the panelists to to amplify, rebut, take issue with what's been said. We have purposely, and we want to thank our panelists for being here today, we have purposely tried to, on this issue of the transmission, governance of the national transmission lines, we've tried to bring people with at least different institutional positions so that we'll try to generate some thorough discussions. I think, as we heard from the commissioner, these are not easy issues. They are very complex issues, as anyone who's been dealing with them, most of you in this room, know. So without further ado, and I will not go into the detailed biographies of each of the speakers because they have been given to you, but first let me pose a question to Bill Gaines, who is the Chief Executive Officer and Director of Utilities at Tacoma Power, and we're particularly delighted to have him here. Bill, let me pose the following question. How do you believe that local governments can best be involved in the planning of the siting of high-priority national transmission lines in order to avoid later disputes? If you could take that off, then we'll let the other panelists respond to your remarks.
Thank you. This is an area where, by the way, I'm here to represent the large Public Power Council today, which is the 23 large municipally owned utilities in the country. This is an area where we actually agree with Chairman Wellinghoff. We think that state and local governments should be given the first opportunity to do siting of lines, including large interstate lines. But we do agree that there probably is a need for federal backstop authority to the extent that states can't ultimately agree. And we think that the presence of that backstop authority would provide impetus to the states and to local governments to get things done. But to the extent that the federal authority ultimately does need to be exercised, we think it ought to give substantial deference to what states and local governments can agree upon. And finally, we didn't talk a lot earlier about cost allocation, but we do not feel that the imposition of federal backstop authority on the siting issue should necessarily be a basis for the use of federal authority to socialize costs.
Anybody want to respond to that?
Well, just hi, I'm Chuck Gray with NARUC. I just note the planning component of the question. Really, I think there's some good news right now that there is our efforts underway in all three interconnections to bring in stakeholders, local governments, and other non-governmental parties to the process of planning the next generation of the transmission system. And I think clearly the kind of folks that Bill represents are going to be participating in that. There are efforts underway in the western states right now through the Western Governors Association that Chairman Wellinghoff mentioned. So I think there is some good news that there are some processes now that are being seriously discussed, seriously implemented, that can address some of these problems. And just on the backstop siting authority, I would agree with Bill's point. And I think the fact that there is backstop siting authority today is clearly an artifact that everybody is living with, and we're trying to make sure that it works as it was intended by Congress in 2005.
Excuse me, just 1 minute. I neglected to introduce our two other panelists. You've heard from two of them now. We have Peter Huber from the Manhattan Institute and Larry Mansuti from DOE. Peter or Larry, do you want to add to either of that?
Well, it's hard not to end up socializing costs whether you like it or not, and I hate socialized costs. But, I mean, if you've got a four-gig line, you know, cutting 1,500 miles across the country, and it's trying to link together, Boone Pickens' wind farm, if he ever builds it, with New York, I mean, and people want on and off ramps all the way. You've got a big and difficult cost issue. We're not going to escape it. I'd love to if we could.
So we have a model in this country that's worked for many years where the direct beneficiaries bear the cost of transmission, just like they bear the cost of the generation itself. We're not sure that a different model is needed.
You know, this, I mean, you know, economic theory worked out about 50 years ago that when you have a big shared capital cost in anything, there actually is no optimum pricing. You try Ramsey pricing if you can, you know, but there just isn't a right number. It ultimately becomes very political. And, you know, if you look at the national economics, they're quite easy. There are tremendous economies to be captured in knitting our nation into one electricity market. I mean, you look at the price dislocations you see across the country, we're seeing 3 or 4 cent price dislocations in wholesale prices at any minute of the day. And as an engineering matter, it's not the slightest doubt you can actually move that power for well under a cent across the country. I mean, you can do it. And so there's a huge economy at that level, but, you know, that means if you're in Iowa or Kansas or, you know, flyover country, I mean, things are going to cut through that aren't serving you. It just will happen.
This is Larry Mansoy, Department of Energy. What I can add is this is exactly the kind of debate that's occurring in Congress on the cost allocation and as well as other issues. Unfortunately, with our electric grid, it's mostly AC, which means it's very difficult for engineers to say that that electron is going from that point to that point, and therefore it makes it very difficult to define things precisely. And so cost allocation ultimately is a political decision of our country or region or what have you between these two kinds of, you know, local beneficiary pays and a national type of or regional type of thing. So it's not really going to be solved by engineers. It's going to be a political choice that collectively we do not make through Congress.
Well, let me throw another zinger out and see if we can't get a bit more controversial. Charles, why don't you take the lead on this one? And the question we have is, how does the fragmentation of the electricity market, both in terms of owners and regulators, affect transmission planning?
Well, as we heard from Chairman Wellinghoff, it makes it more difficult. There's no question that if we had a single owner of the entire grid in the United States, publicly owned, for example, managed like the federal highway system, it would be a lot easier to plan transmission than the current system where you've got at least four different categories of ownership, municipals, co-ops, IOUs, the federal government is a major owner of transmission assets. And all of those parties are going to have to participate in the planning process. I can just come back to my last answer that there are initiatives underway through the stimulus money and I know Larry's probably going to be up to his elbows in this at some point, but we see some efforts that are coming together where, particularly in the Eastern Interconnection, where parties are coming together both at the industry level that Chairman Wellinghoff mentioned when he mentioned the group that was coming together in the Eastern Interconnection of transmission owners. There's sort of a parallel effort being made by the state officials, including governors and other public utility commissioners, those kinds of folks, to try and come up with an interconnection-wide planning process that builds consensus as much as possible. That said, there are clearly the fact that you have new procedures in place isn't going to solve the same kind of problems that we heard this morning already. People worry about importing coal from the Midwest in New Jersey. People worry about losing offshore wind in New England because of lines that bring power in from other parts of the country. So all of those problems don't go away simply because you have a better process.
No, in fact, let's be frank, they get worse. I mean, if you're in one corner of the country and you've got high-cost power there and a lot of politically influential people in that corner who have just deadbeat assets, they ought to be shut down for whatever reason, because you don't like their green credentials or because you don't like their money credentials. I'm more interested in the money myself. But anyway, the fact is that, the grid is an enemy of everybody who's seriously above cost on their production. And there are a lot. I mean, we don't live in Wake Wobegon. Half the country is above average and half is below, right? And the grid flattens that out. It will have many local enemies, okay? And it will have, the proponents will tend to be physically further away because often somebody far away has cheaper real estate and a friendlier regulator or is nearer a big gas pipeline or is sitting on a field of stranded gas that can generate electrons right there. I mean, there's many of these scenarios. There'll be lots of local resistance in at least half the time.
Anybody else?
That, unfortunately, is the reality of the situation. One can think back in the wars on trying to get, there's a national push earlier in this decade to have standard market design. i.e. have these RTOs all over the country, these centralized, organized electricity markets, well, that failed in the West, outside of California, and in the Southeast for many of these reasons. They had low-cost power, and they were afraid of importation of a higher-cost power that would, or exportation of their low-cost power to the high-cost power areas for these very reasons. So these issues are not electrical engineering issues. They're all political issues, sometimes hiding as technical issues, which one of the reasons we have this forum today. They're difficult to solve.
Okay, Larry, we'll come back to you again. How should a high-priority national transmission project be defined, and how should the electricity policy be adapted to accommodate high-priority national transmission projects?
Well, first, I'll start by just citing the chairman. Wellinghoff mentioned existing law. Existing law does say under EPAC 2005 that DOE does a congestion study every 3 years. We've got one right now sitting at the White House waiting for final review to be issued at any time. Following that study, the Secretary of Energy can, if he or she chooses to, designate certain geographic footprints as national interest electricity transmission corridors, really areas. And then there's backstop siting there. Those geographic footprints, the law says, well, those are areas that DOE deems, under federal law, certain parameters of national interest to resolve that congestion. Now, it doesn't say that DOE were supposed to go out and say, you must build transmission. It could be distributed generation efficiency and so forth. Congress did say, though, if a transmission line is built, then if the state doesn't act within certain parameters, there's been a court case on that and so forth. Some folks say that may have been weakened by the court case, then it goes to FERC. So that's how it's currently defined, in a sense. We have all the different proposals before Congress that are being sorted out or will not be, depending on how legislation goes. We currently also have how the where the administration stands. The administration wants more efficiency, renewables, coal sequestration, nuclear deployed. Go to whitehouse.gov, you can see it all there, what the administration policy is. But also, the president has mentioned his interest in the State of the Union of having coast-to-coast wind and solar renewables. That implies transmission. I can't give a specific answer to your question because the administration is still undergoing review of its transmission policy. Chairman FERC is at an independent, Chairman Wellinghoff of FERC is at an independent agency, so he's able to espouse his views on that. Well, we haven't settled on anything yet in the administration, but there's been intensive review sponsored by the Council on Environmental Quality. Chairman Wellinghoff has been in those discussions as well as other cabinet secretaries looking at various bills before Congress and where we should go. Pragmatically, though, what is occurring? What is occurring is a stimulus bill, the Stimulus Act. There's funds in there for loan guarantees as well as other types of generation and energy efficiency and all that kind of stuff. So there may be some lines that go for, very large lines that may go for loan guarantees. There's a large amount of trial balloon transmission projects in the West trying to get buyers and sellers to agree. They've been in trial balloon phase for a year or two. Western Governors Association, Western Interstate Energy Board has a great map showing all these proposals. Some of them may be fleshed out and become commercial, where they actually become real finance projects through some, think about $6 or $7 billion in loans, borrowing authority that Bonneville Power Administration and Western Area Power Administration has. They've got a tremendous amount of proposals coming in, and some of those that one would call national interest or significant lines may end up being financed. I like Chairman Wellinghoff's, the last point I was going to make, how they're going to be perhaps defined pragmatically with stimulus money. The lock them in the room approach. Well, that's the approach that Congress gave us when they gave us authority at DOE to issue $80 million to support interconnection regional planning. We've got an RFP out on that on the street. Proposals due by this Monday, east, west, and Texas. That is literally what we're doing there with our funds in the east and the west, Texas. We've got an RFP topic A that says we want all the technical folks to get together, all the engineers, utilities, and so forth, on an interconnection-wide basis, east as well, Texas, to come together and do interconnection-wide transmission planning in a public, participatory format and in a heavily scenario basis, meaning lots of look at alternative scenarios, non-wire scenarios, non-transmission scenarios. Because we feel that's critical. If you're going to site transmission, you have to make the case, we really need this transmission line. We're doing as much as possible on non-wires, DG efficiency, and so forth. We think that's crucial, particularly to get folks together. And we're also, topic B, funding the states. Groups of regional entities that can claim that they have the support of the governor are welcome to submit proposals to us. We've heard some of those names earlier by other folks. And in the East, that's going to be a tough slot because Eastern Interconnection is 40 states. The West has a good track record. And from our standpoint, until Congress acts and says this is what national transmission lines should be or not be or what have you, that's probably going to be the game in town where the East and the West, the states, working together with industry and interest groups, interested parties, have a crack at being in the room. And the last point is that I've heard from many state commissioners among themselves and to us and public statements saying this is our last crack at the state level for us to work regionally, interconnection-wide together and try to crack this all these different nuts. And if not, then federal siting authority may need to come in. And in fact, they've been warning themselves, hey, we have to be in this room. We have to, from the Southeast, be in the same room with folks from New England and try to solve this. Otherwise, which is, frankly, a tough thing to do culturally in this country. You know?
Bring a translator.
Yeah, we did have a civil war at one time. No?
I've been in those rooms.
Chuck has been in those rooms. And so they know that they're under the gun at the state level to get it done. This experiment may fail, and Congress may act either now or in a few years and do something.
Thank you. Anybody want to comment on that? Chuck?
Yeah, I would just note, and I think Larry made an important point, between the difference between what we were talking about in 2005, which was relieving congestion. The corridors at that point, the national interest was in relieving congestion to make markets work better. I think that's clearly what you saw in the debate leading up to that legislation. It seems to me it's a very different debate right now. And the question, I think one important question that hasn't been a lot of time spent on is the open access non-discriminatory policy of Order 888 for access to the transmission system still a national policy? I'm not sure it is.
Well, we observe that it's still a national law.
It's a national law, but doesn't all of this, favored access to certain technologies, all of that sort of run counter to the open access policy that we...
Well, I think it does, but I think our view would be those things could coexist. Okay. And we might even support broader federal backstop authority than just for renewables-related mm-hmm. facilities.
You know, if you want the prime example in our federal law of lots and lots of contending criteria and interests coexisting, you know, open the federal tax code, all right? And there is a line for green and a line for this and 12,000 pages of regulation later, nobody knows where they are. And there is a very high risk that the grid goes exactly that way. I mean, you're saying this, you said, I agree with everything you said, actually, but you said it's not an engineering problem. The very first word you used, of course, was end congestion, which is an entirely engineering problem. Am I going to burn this sucker to the ground? Is it going to fall down when it gets hot, you know, or is it going to keep carrying the load? I mean, if Baltimore doesn't have a congestion problem. They have no power, okay? So if they raise prices sky high, there'll be no more congestion. They want to import it from somewhere else. They've got their own homegrown problem. Now, with all this talk, let us not lose focus. There is a single, pretty darn clear, objective economic metric of what we ought to want if we actually want to maximize U.S. wealth, and that is After you've put in your environmental and whatever loads you want to on the node, the little round points on the map, okay, and loaded those costs wherever you want to put them, you actually want a grid that then gives us a national market. And so that if you've got a 3 cent price location, but you can move the power for 1 cent, that you'll move it. I mean, that will make America as a whole wealthiest. And over time, it ought to be a positive sum game where you really, FERC makes these maps. You can look at, I mean, there are big, big price spreads, and they're, of course, time of day within any region, but then geographically, they're just enormous. I mean, factors of two in average retail prices and so on. And on the wholesale markets, we should be beating them. I mean, it's free money. At 765 kV, you can move this stuff 3,000 miles. The losses are small, and it's not expensive. We're talking a fraction of a penny to move it that far, or maybe a penny.
Do any of you see any dangers that the government seems to be choosing the technological winners of the system rather than simply concentrating on...
That's the whole danger. It's everything, all the time. I mean, and locally they're choosing it. I mean, everybody is guarding their little bit of turf, which is good locally in the short term and bad nationally in the long.
Charles, we would agree with that. We would rather see the end goals legislated and allow some flexibility on the part of utilities and regulators and local jurisdictions to meet them. I think if we unnecessarily constrain the problem, the solutions get contorted.
And one aspect about that is, from a good standpoint, with all this interest in carbon legislation and so forth, all this alarm about climate change, coupled with, hey, all the bus and property values and so forth, all that money has been looking for a place to invest. We've seen these massive trends of venture capital going into all these new energy technologies, but that also means we don't know today in 2009 which one of those technologies or suites of technologies will be the killer apps 10, 20 years from now. Some folks say rooftop photovoltaics is poised with all the billions in capital investment to break out and be so cost effective that people will be buying them automatically. There are people who say this in about a decade, just like they automatically buy cell phones and go off the telephone grid, or geothermal in the east. There's some technologies to do that and so forth, or low-cost nuclear, if you believe that, and so forth. So if we take as a nation, place our bets too early, will there be economic losses from doing that? So one hand, it's great that we have all this technology blooming, but if we pick the wrong ones too early, will that pose problems for us economically?
In fact, one of our concerns about cost socialization is that if you do that in favor of large centralized wind, you probably prejudice other renewable forms, and you probably prejudice economic efficiency to some degree.
Well, this is not a new issue. PURPA started defining,
yes,
preferential types of technologies. This was 1978. You know, that's when we first lost our virginity on this issue, and now it's just a question of how much farther we go. And RPS is essentially picking winning technologies, and that's got a lot of support for very good reasons. But I don't think we'll ever see a neutral policy if we ever had one.
Yeah, I mean, to remember how bad it gets, lest we forget. For 9 years, it was actually illegal to build
a new gas-fired
power plant. Now it's essentially mandatory. So in the space of 20 years, it's a crime, or else you get a Nobel Prize. I mean, that's about it.
Yeah. I hear from some old-timers in the utility industry complain, look, UDUE, under federal law in the early 80s, 70s, in order to build a gas plant, we had to come to you and get a permit. So that was a big hassle. You eventually would rubber stamp us, but these permits to build gas as gas supply increased. But then, so we went out and built gas, coal plants. Now we're being told, oh, coal is bad, we have to clean it out. So if you look at some long-term trends, and we have to do careful look at what we choose to do as federal laws. Things change over decades' time.
The chairman seemed to suggest that, seemed to say he had a preference for having these issues dealt with at the state and regional levels, but with clear backstop if that didn't happen to move towards some kind of federal preemption. Question I'd like to ask, to what extent do you think there's any prospect that somebody opposed to a particular thing that FERC would like a national interest court, to what extent would there be any grounds for a challenge to the U.S. Supreme Court on whether FERC has such jurisdiction?
Well, there was a decision after Order 888 about the commission then took jurisdiction over unbundled retail transmission, under unbundled retail service, and the court upheld that decision. We were parties to that case. And the court hinted, I think, that the commission, if it so chose, could also assert jurisdiction over bundled retail transmission, which it didn't do, and it hasn't subsequently. But I think there may be some, they may have some authority that they could rely on for an expansion on their own of their own authority, at least to the extent of taking authority over the entire transmission network as it relates to both retail and wholesale service, including services provided by the vertically integrated utilities that now operate, say, in the Southeast or the Northwest. I think there would be a huge political pushback on that from those regions, but I think if the commission wanted to take an aggressive approach, you know, those kinds of cases would be the ones that they would cite.
Now, obviously, I can't speak for the commission. Looking at natural gas, it's been able to cite natural gas pipelines. There's been opposition that they've had to deal with court suits and EISs and so forth. But natural gas, the lines are buried. Transmission, until someone comes up with the killer app of having to cheaply bury transmission lines, superconductivity, or some other newfangled technology, they're going to be above ground. And, you know, human nature is, to some folks, they're not pretty. you know, there's that, to some folks, that's a NIMBY thing. To some folks, they don't like seeing them. So federal siting authority, it could help, but it's no panacea, because if you're in our modern democracy, with all the laws and ability to sue and stop and voice your opinion and rights, if local groups don't like these transmission lines, they're going to be delayed or bollocked up, and, you know, there'll be things occurring at FERC because they're above ground. You can see them.
Peter, let me ask you a question to lead us off. How have the last three decades of utility restructuring shaped the modernization process of the electricity grid, and has this necessarily been good for consumers?
Well, when you wrote that, I assume by restructuring you mean essentially the separation of generation from wires. And I think, you know, let's quickly run through from three perspectives. I think on the generation side, it actually did much, not all, but much of what was hoped. I mean, to pick one example, probably not the favorite du jour, but the nuclear power business was taken over by essentially one company, and it got very good at running these plants, and it got them uprated at the NRC, and it raised capacity factors from 70% to 90%, and without building a single new plant, I mean, we had a huge expansion in output, and you got the merchant generators and wild competition. So that was what was foreseen and planned and expected. Basically, you created incentives to get much more efficient. I would say, on balance, the incentive on the grid was close to exactly the opposite, or certainly zero and negative. I mean, you basically have somebody in the old system, you know, you had one person owning both, and you splashed the money around a bit. You were going to put some in wires, some in plant, and there. That's basically you get to make those choices rationally within your own universe, even if the regulatory structure creates weird incentives. Once you separate the two, the person who owns the wires has actually, I would say, zero or negative incentive to go out and connect to the cheapest producer. That tends to be somebody far away. It means you've got bigger problems of, you know, lines going down. You're sitting in Baltimore. Do you really want to rely on Ohio or Manhattan? You know, New York actually has a law. You've got to generate locally 80% or something. You can't import it all from Montreal. And it's a cost-through process if you own the wires. So, you know, it's expensive power. We'll pass that on. We get our margin. That's the core incentive. And you don't have money splashing around to build wires anymore. And that's why we have problems. So we got a huge expansion in competitive generation and lots of people far away generating very good electricity. We lost, if anything, our cash and our sort of centralized managerial authority to build out wires. And then on the third hand, back to the power plants, I mean, you know, you really mobilize the independents and the merchants on one side versus the local producers on the other, and they are simply in direct opposition. I mean, if you own a gas peaker that's not a very good peaker somewhere on the East Coast, and there's somebody sitting on free gas 1,000 miles away who can put peak electrons your way, you don't want more wires. You want fewer wires. I mean, you want more gas pipelines, but you want less grid. And I would say, if anything, we solved some problems, but we put the focus on how unsolved the grid problem is.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
I would just note that a lot of consumers paid stranded cost payments for those nuclear plants that are the gems of the industry right now, that are getting market-based prices that have nothing to do with their costs. It's a great, great thing to own a nuclear plant these days.
If you know how to run it.
Exactly.
If you know how to run
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what I heard is that there is pluses and minuses to what occurred. That's my personal analytical view, not the Department of Energy or administration, because we have no position on electric construction in the administration. Because of my professional background, a lot of the hat I've worn in the last decade or two is also on the demand side, efficiency side. One of the negatives of, unfortunately, of restructuring that there, in the 90s, there was a deer in the headlights look among utilities and others on investing in efficiency because, other aspects of capital, waiting for this new restructured markets and who's going to own what to occur. And so things like energy efficiency was left, the thought was the market will do that. That was even in the Clinton administration, the view that the retail restructured markets would bring massive energy efficiency and renewables and so forth. And now we've been seeing a big push now, re-interest. The fact that Edison Electric Institute has Lisa Wood, Institute of Energy Efficiency, National Action Plan for Energy Efficiency, where the nation's utilities came together and regulators and said, we need more energy efficiency. That's been a resurgent. But in some aspects, electric restructuring caused a deer-in-the-headlights wait for certain things to happen, and that is a negative. There were positives as well, too.
I think from our perspective, the objective of regulation was really not grid modernization. It was something else, and probably we did achieve at least parts of something else. But I think what's going to drive grid modernization is not that. Somebody observed earlier that it's a little more about politics than it is about engineering, and I think that's probably right.
Do you think unbundling and restructuring was a good or a bad thing for the deployment of smart grid technology? We've had some people suggest to us that in a vertically integrated system, the deployment of smart grid technology can occur much more efficiently than it can when you have a more fragmented ownership system. Well, do you agree or disagree?
I would agree with that. I mean, in general, public power and entities in the Northwest oppose restructuring in that region. We were successful, so we largely are still vertically integrated. You see a number of smart grid proposals rolling out under the stimulus bill in our part of the country, including my utility, and we're doing it for reasons really unrelated to the restructuring of the industry. You also see a large rollout of energy efficiency in our part of the country for reasons unrelated to restructuring, just basic energy economics.
Yeah. I want to pick up a thread that Chairman Wolinoff mentioned. He mentioned integrated resource planning. Well, in the West, you have mostly vertically integrated utilities still, and they still practice integrated resource planning. The major utilities there are required to file with their PUC. The public power utilities do integrated resource planning. And there is an advantage to being one person making the rational choices, assuming you have a good IRP process between generation, transmission, and the demand side. You have that in the Southeast. For those areas that have markets, essentially organized markets, yeah, you do have the problem of deploying some of these technologies because you don't have one owner. The fix there has been to try to do it through market design. Chairman Wolinoff mentioned the forward capacity markets, both in New England and PJM. They do allow demand-side resources, which can be smart grid-enabled, to compete equally. That it is possible to do it in non-vertically integrated areas, you have to engineer some kind of market system, which always takes time to get perfect and get right. Well, you can never get a market perfect.
Okay, Larry, if I could direct this question to you, and then we'll move to the audience. How does the development of a renewable energy portfolio standard influence the siting and financing of electric transmission lines?
Totally. I'm thinking particularly in the West. That is literally the main thing that's driving the Western Governors Association and the entire West to pursue long-distance transmission lines. They've said we right now it's very difficult to do nuclear or coal with sequestration in the West. The only options we have are efficiency and renewables in the West. We don't want to do more gas because of over-reliance on natural gas. And that is literally driving the Western Renewable Energy Zones project with the transmission. And the last point is on the utility side. The utility industry themselves have organized a Western Electric Industry Leaders, all the major utilities in the West, the big ones, Public Power, Co-op, investor-owned. They formed a little rump group of all their CEOs. They paid for some number crunching modeling to be done, and voila, their modeling resulted in a letter to all the governors in the West, all the PUC commissioners saying, hey, we've got climate pressure, we've got RPSs to meet. We really need access to location-constrained renewables. We need to build transmission. Please help us. Don't stand in the way, governors. And Western Governors, you know, has been in correspondence with them through the Western Governors Association. So totally is the answer in the West. And increasingly, perhaps, in the East, the Eastern interconnection with a caveat. Well, I say perhaps because there are 10 states in the East, Eastern Governors, Virginia, all the way up to New England, that have sent a letter to the Senate Energy Committee and CC a lot of folks in town saying, we're not interested in long-distance renewable transmission lines. We think we want to do them regionally around here, build out renewables and efficiency and other generation sources. So more so in the West, somewhat in the East.
Anybody else have an opinion on that?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I'm sure you're right. I know you're right. And that's about the only thing out there that would make me, because I'm getting old and I've seen a lot of this, okay, think, gee, scrap the whole thing, okay, because we will regret it. If you have any green memories at all, you clearly remember the day when the grid was the brittle enemy of green, okay? You wanted less grid, okay? I mean, you'd stop the grid at all costs because it led to big centralized power plants. All the numbers were wrong. It was bunk beginning to end, but nevertheless, it shaped policy for 20 years. Now the Greens are suddenly, or some Greens, not by any means all, but a flip to the other end. We desperately need a line to solar in the middle of Nevada, you know, or to wind in Texas. Very good, but you know, these are very long-lived resources. They are all capital up front. I mean, you can spend huge amounts of money on this, and you know, you can make the stranded costs of a nuke here or there look small compared with a grid to nowhere, you know? I mean, everybody, you know, no, look, keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, world politics changes more than you think, okay, in a lifetime. You may think carbon's a done deal. I'll tell you, if India and China don't come in on this, okay, and say we're going our own way, which is probably as likely as not right now, okay, I suspect carbon isn't a done deal, okay, because we will find that it is just economically ruinous to go it alone when we control, you know, way under half of the world's carbon supply, less than half of the carbon emissions. You know, China's the biggest emitter. The developing world is 55%. And unless this global treaty coalesces and gets enforced, a lot of these things won't last as long as people think. If you have a long memory in this business, you do not invest for the long term based on the latest regulatory winds, because they're more changeable than you think.
Larry, I'd just like to pick up on your last comment that the West at least doesn't want to get over-reliant on natural gas. Does this make sense when we've had the greatest additions to natural gas supplies in this country over the last 4 years or so, and many people in the gas industry will argue that the reserve base may even be much greater than even the farthest numbers have been projected? I mean, there are people who are beginning to say gas should not only be utilized, that it can take away market share from coal, which even though it may not be the preferred option, is certainly better than the burning of coal from a CO2 perspective. And it would also, you know, develop American jobs and keep jobs that are right now being lost in the oil and gas production patch.
Two-part answer. First, that's a very good point, because that's a recent development, the Marcellus formations and so forth, that discovery, and that's great. Sometimes there is good news in the energy and electricity business, like that find of oil in the Gulf, a massive find. what occurred in the West, when they set up that process I described, that was done when natural gas looked scarce or expensive or national security problems, getting all this LNG from overseas. And we're hoping that actually, as part of the interconnection-wide planning we're going to fund in the West, that the West revisit some of their assumptions because of this natural gas. And that's hopefully one of the scenarios they're going to be running. Of course, there's the caveat that some folks say that if you run a greatly expand wind, you do need to build something to help with the intermittency or do change some practices. One of the answers, there are many, is building more gas plants to back up the wind.
Just one other observation on the use of gas in the West. I think it's not because utilities wouldn't like to do it, but you need to keep in mind that most of the Western states, at least where the loads are, have put RES laws in place. And so most utilities in the West are scrambling to buy renewables in order to meet the RES requirements, you know, without regard to the economics of integrated resource planning.
That's true.
But we think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Depends on your view on the carbon thing, I think.
And that's up to the voters of that state.
And can California is paying twice the retail cost of electricity as Indiana? Okay, well, an all-gas state versus an all-coal state.
Chuck, could we ask just one final question before we turn to the audience, and that is in terms of the siting authority for high-priority transmission lines, how do you think the responsibility should be shared, if indeed it should be shared, between the states and the feds? And what can we do to incentivize private investment in transmission lines?
I guess I need to be careful on this a little bit, speaking for myself and speaking for NARUC. we have shared jurisdiction right now. As we know, as we discussed a few minutes ago, there's backstop siting authority that goes to FERC. It's been in existence for 4 years. FERC has yet to site a power line using it. So there's one application now pending. Does FERC need more robust backstop siting authority? That's what the current debate is about in Congress. I think there are members, some commissions that think that would be a good idea. Clearly, inconsistent with what Peter was saying, that there's haves and have-nots. There are commissions that are frustrated by the inability of the state-by-state system to build new power lines, that they want to import cheaper power, they want to sell power out into other markets, and they see that as being frustrated by the way the siting in other states is concerned, and that, but there are other states that, for a lot of reasons, strongly would oppose any kind of expanded federal authority over the siting of power lines for the kind of reasons. And it's interesting how the arguments have somewhat shifted, because it may result in bringing in high carbon generation. As I think Chairman Wellinghoff addressed that problem, I think he's probably right that those plants in the Midwest are probably near capacity most of the time anyway, so it might not be as big a problem as some people think. But then the offshore wind in New England, those folks want to take that first, and maybe the National Corridor would frustrate that policy. So I think we're going to muddle through. I suspect Congress, though, there is some momentum right now for expanded federal authority to do this, and I fairly expect as that goes forward there will be some expansion of FERC's authority, perhaps along the lines that Chairman Wellinghoff expanded backstop authority nationwide, not in just in zones, and some kind of a period of time for a bottoms-up approach to both siting as well as planning to operate, and then have it transferred to the federal authorities when the states fail to move the ball.
Okay, we'll turn to the audience now. If you would please identify yourself and direct the question to one of the panelists to lead off the answer to your remarks. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Leonard Oberlander. We're talking about national systems, pipelines, grids, and so forth. And I'd like to follow what Peter Huber said last and the following comments by the panelists with a question about the changing, let's say, entrepreneurial spirit that may accompany the use of gas and gas pipelines for transporting gas and industrial uses of gas as well as the electric grids. In the context of financing into the future, where there's money to be made, there will be corporations, people, governments there to benefit from it. So following on what Peter Huber said, why not consider even a vertically integrated structure that either produces or imports gas, for instance, and then transports it and injects it into the industrial use in factories. Having one corporation do this, one group of private investors, if that's going to be profitable and efficient. And what is the role of investors that we've been talking about, not only American investors, but private equity investors that are national, international, foreign national, and others? Where is the legal and regulatory framework standing today with regard to international investment, partial or total foreign ownership of certain of the energy assets? I'll end the question there because it's narrower than I'm thinking about it, but it's very difficult to grasp the essence of the legal and regulatory ramifications of the very many different kinds of private and intergovernmental investments in this.
Anybody want to take that?
I'm not an expert on the foreign investment. I'm in telecom. I know there are quite strong limits on foreign ownership of infrastructure facilities. I don't know what they are in energy, but I will. There is a very important point you raise, and I'm a telecom lawyer, or used to be, and I will tell you that all of these issues played out about two decades earlier in the telecom business than they did in the energy business. We've seen them all right? And I'll tell you this. The models we've been through are complete vertical integration, which was AT&T or the old utilities, okay. Rigid separation. You slice the generation off here, and you put the transmission over there. And they both have their problems. And I actually, and by the way, in telecom, we finally worked our way through, and we got a sort of messy hybrid, which is almost certainly the best. The best analogy I know is if you're trying to put up a 100-story skyscraper in New York, okay, if somebody said, look, you've got to build it and then, you know, have equal access and the FERC rules on who can buy what at what price, it would never get built, okay? The only way a skyscraper gets built, a huge capital investment, is with anchor tenants, okay? You get a developer, but you also have two or three or four people who will buy the first 20 stories and put up a lot of capital, and you want it that way because there's actually a cohesion of interest. You have exactly the same thing in electricity. A power plant without a grid beside it is valueless, and a grid without a power plant is valueless, and the complete separation with FERC trying to run it all is, I think, a serious mistake. There ought to be some middle ground that actually lets some equity ownership you will never go to a completely integrated system again. If you're going to have public rights of way across the country for pipelines or wires or so on, you will have public access rules. You won't have somebody monopolizing that monopoly structure for their nukes or their wind power or their anything. It just won't happen. But you can't. These are capacious grids. I mean, you know, one 765 line can carry something like 1% of the total average U.S. electric power consumption. I mean, it's fantastic amounts of power in one line, and you ought to be able to find some middle ground where you can draw in private capital, which will want to make a profit, because currently the grid owners don't make spectacular profits. Not the place to go for big money. Little money, yes, but not big money. But you want the venture capital in there. That will drive your efficiency. They'll look for the DC alternatives where they make sense rather than the AC. The two sort of completely pure versions have both, in my view, serious limitations. There should be a middle ground that lets serious private money, for-profit money, flow into the grid.
Just on the foreign investment question, it was under the Public Utility Holding Company Act that was essentially foreclosed, but that was repealed. So now we see foreign ownership of, you know, Scottish Power, National Grid come in, and they own utilities. So the kinds of restrictions maybe on the telecom side have actually been lifted on the energy side. So you know, those markets are open.
Not on the grid. I mean, the grid, you have the open access rules. I mean, I've studied.
Right.
You cannot. It's very. New York wanted this. You got people who want to build a line because they want to build a plant at the other end. They just can't do it. There's total. They can't get the guarantee that if they build a line, they will then get to put their power into
Absolutely.
It, and that's a serious problem.
And the same thing's true on natural gas, because of an open access pipeline system, too.
And I think you need half open access. I've seen this in telecom. You got a fiber line. It's fantastically capacious. You know, Verizon, whoever's building it, wants to be the anchor tenant. They want their stuff going down there. They built the line, after all, and we litigated that for 20 years, and more or less they got the right to do that. You can't turn everything into a common carrier. You just won't pull in the private capital.
All the way in the back?
Hello, this is a question for Mr. Huber. My name is Jonathan Schneider, and I'm an attorney that labors in these vineyards. Just slightly before my time, and only slightly.
Mic. Can you raise your mic, please?
Sure. Again, the question is for Mr. Huber. Just a little before my time, the nation faced a challenge of similar magnitude. It was the transportation challenge. And the question was how we moved people and goods and services from one part of this country to the other. And Congress settled, of course, on not just an objective, but a solution, a means to an end. And that was the interstate highway system. And the highway system was accomplished in significant part effectively by socializing the cost through tax revenue. Now, we did achieve the objective, but we did so by foreclosing a range of alternatives. For a generation, we foreclosed mass transit. For a generation, we made it quite conceivable to spread civilization throughout what was otherwise pristine wilderness. Turning to the electric grid, it occurs to me that we may very well be in the same position. We have a challenge that Congress may very well rise to through either cap-and-trade legislation or an RES. And the question is whether it would be wiser to allow us to enable entrepreneurs and others to provide the right solutions, most economically and the most environmentally correct way, by their own lights without dictating the solution.
Well, dictating is a strong word. I actually had stepped down here, but I haven't gotten my hold on it. My piece of grid wire. Okay, it's somebody got in the room. It's just a piece of wire. It's this fat around. At power, it carries five jumbo jets of engines straight down the wire. This big. Okay, it's a lot of power. One line, which has 14 of them, something about 50 jumbo jets of energy going down that. I will assert to you, just simply as a quantitative basis. I mean, raw numbers. This isn't political opinion. That stuff, okay, has done more to improve the efficiency, the basic thermodynamic efficiency of our energy economy in this country than every improvement in car engines since the day of Henry Ford, okay? Because big centralized plants let you jack up the temperature way high, okay, and you get tremendous thermodynamic efficiency. Now, that may be changing in the future. And by the way, don't take it from me. Read the report of the World Wildlife Fund called Plugged In from last year. You know, I mean, you get huge economies when you can, you know, put your plants where you can do your pollution control, where you can jack up the temperatures. I mean, spreading loads, flattening things out has been. This is what hybrid cars do in a tiny way. They flatten out the load for that little engine and you double your fuel economy. The grid's been doing that for the electric economy for a century. That happens to be an engineering judgment. And of course, new technology could change that completely for the next century. But the fact is that, oh, there it is, okay. Five jumbo jets at 765 kVs, down one of these, okay? The only way to not meddle, okay, is to say no grid, no pipelines, let's have everything local. It's a charming vision, okay? Amory Lovins has been pushing it for 40 years. It ain't close to economic reality. I mean, you can dream all you like. You won't see it in your lifetime, okay? We are not going to do 4,000 terawatt hours, okay, of electricity with rooftop solar. Not in your lifetime, okay? Nowhere close.
Any further questions? Yes, ma'am.
Good morning. As we migrate, I'm sorry, Deborah Brown, Harris Cyber Unit, as we migrate to smart, critical infrastructures, obviously vulnerabilities increase. The keynote today talked about security, but just mentioned security, and I was wondering if the four of you had any comments from a cyber perspective.
My view simply is it's a concern, but it's not insurmountable. I mean, it's not a reason not to go forward with modernization of the grid.
I would happen to agree with that. It's part of modern life, the march toward more IT in our lives. Now we're seeing this big push for increasing the amount of IT. We've always had IT in the electric industry. It's not like we've never had a smart grid. We're just going to increase it quite a bit. If we look at other lives, other parts of our lives, it's a security concern. We all have the spam and all that kind of stuff with our internet. Unfortunately, it's also the reason why we have to do all these passwords and user codes and how do you remember them all. That kind of stuff, hopefully, perhaps better than that, will have to be addressed. It has to be addressed with this smart grid, both at the host, at the transmission, at the distribution level.
But if I could add just one thing, there's no question whatsoever that your most reliable power source is a diesel genset on premises and a big tank of diesel in the back, okay? It's not cheap at all. The second most reliable, however, is not one line stretching, 500 miles, but a densely interconnected grid, a mesh grid, essentially, so that, when one set goes down, you've got two or three other pathways. New York internally almost never loses power because its grid is so dense, It's got six paths to your building. I mean, whatever blows up, it really takes something to bring down New York. We could be building a much more interconnected national grid. We ought to interconnect our three regions. Big challenge, but we should do it.
Or as some folks on the next panel will espouse, don't consume the electricity. Conserve that.
Even more reliable.
Yeah.
No energy.
Yeah.
I do call the audience's attention to a recent study that was chaired by Jim Schlesinger, former defense and energy secretary, which for DOD, which argues that because of the cyber threat security problem, that all military bases in the United States should be on their own energy systems and not connected to the grid anywhere. If you haven't seen that study, it's a very interesting one.
But they are. I mean, National Airport is all the everybody who's got absolutely critical loads, the New York Stock Exchange, all have their own. They've got distributed generation, folks. It's all diesel gen sets. And you don't like it. I mean, it's expensive, it's dirty, it's everything you don't want.
Yes, sir.
So another version of an earlier question, if every study of metropolitan climate protection shows that to get an 80 to 90% reduction in emissions by 2050, you have to not only deal with technology, but you have to deal with spatial form. And we're starting to do that. One scenario might be that, in fact, we have started to get on that path, and we end up with a more efficient country. If we do that, it seems like that we end up with a virtuous self-fulfilling prophecy. We set the goal for carbon reduction and security and end up with a more economically efficient United States because things are distributed in metropolitan form that makes a lot of sense. If that were to happen, it seems to me that to go to the point that you made about Amory Lovins, which I think was misstated, you would end up with both efficiency and distributed generation, and you would end up with it in a much more efficient form, and you wouldn't need quite as much transmission capacity, and the lines wouldn't be in the same places as if you plan today on assumptions of spatial form under business as usual. I'd be interested in any positions that any of you have on that, because that's not hypothetical. In another part of this building, they're holding these same discussions today and every day about that spatial form, because that's a live debate and a policy set of options that this administration seems to be starting to commit to. How does that affect some of the framing that you've just laid out here, which so far hasn't been on a spatial basis, other than to talk about this war between the states? Thank you.
just on the transmission planning piece that we talked a little bit about, one of the things that the stimulus money is going to pay for are a series of scenarios that are going to be run through the planning process, and I suspect that they're going to be, I know some of our commissioners are interested in looking at very different kind of approaches to the structure of the industry that I'm not sure it responds directly to your question, but I think there are going to be some folks that want to look at sort of out-of-the-box kind of approaches to transmission planning.
I'll give a two-part answer. One is to agree with Chuck. If you look at our RFP, the code words, as much as we put them in there, say we want robust planning under many different scenarios. Geez, you could almost whisper it's integrated resource planning, though in some parts of the country that's a bad word, so we didn't use that. We didn't want to bring up those battles of the late 80s and so forth. And pragmatically, my second answer is pragmatically looking at the controversies in building transmission line that have occurred in some parts of the country, not all parts of the country, if you don't bring that early into the dialogue of looking at alternatives to transmission, you're going to have trouble building that line, siding that line. You have to, in our modern society, address those points.
I think it's a good point and a good question. And if you think about kind of what the real drivers are behind these large high-voltage grid proposals, a cynic might say that the wind industry is trying to legislate its own business plan.
Lisa? Mike?
I just want to actually follow up on that question. It seems to me if we had a carbon goal, we wouldn't be sort of talking about RPSs on the one hand and building transmission and having energy efficiency resource standards and various other things state by state. We would just basically do what makes sense to meet the carbon goal, and that would be a mix of energy efficiency, distributed generation, and renewables in the right mix. But in this, since we have so much uncertainty around carbon, instead we have 25 or 30 states at this point with renewable standards, so and leaving us scrambling about how we're going to meet the renewable standards. So we're talking about building huge transmission lines, and it's extremely expensive. So I guess I don't know if I have a question so much as a comment. I mean, it seems to me that because of all this uncertainty around the carbon legislation, we're putting all these pieces in place, whereas just having the carbon legislation would let everybody plan efficiently. So I don't know if you wanted to respond to that.
Could I actually, question, there are carbon-free alternatives that are not small distributed. I mean, the Nukes, can knock out all our coal 100% with 250 plants. If we had finished building the plants that were in the pipeline before the TMI accident, we would, if we could conjure those plants just into existence, we would put ourselves into compliance with Kyoto just like that. I mean, there are, our grid today, on a carbon-based average is about as good, just about as good as an all-gas grid, 100%, because the uranium plus the hydro bring it down enough. That's not a bad starting point. If you take the electrons off this grid, which is 50% coal, and displace the oil in your cars, according to the World Wildlife Fund, pretty straightforward calculations, you lower carbon footprint because you're using a 45% efficient generator to displace a 25% car engine. I mean, there are very, Pickens wants to do wind. He's put a lot of money on it, but he doesn't want to do them distributed. He thinks in Texas, where it's windy and there's nobody who lives, is better than maybe off Cape Cod, and he may well be right. I mean, but he can't do it unless you connect him to Massachusetts.
I think this is a very good point, and I'd like for it not to get lost, because as a utility executive, we're on the implementation end of all this. And if the overall goal is, carbon reduction, let's just say so and allow people to get on with it and use some innovation. But if you say to the utility executive, well, what I really want you to do is reduce carbon, but I want you to use this particular form of renewable, and I won't let you interchange energy efficiency for that particular form of renewable, and you must do it with a transmission line that I, the federal government, will, divine and cite, you pretty soon get a constrained problem that's very difficult to solve. And I think from our perspective, we'd rather have the high-level objective stated and allow some innovation to flourish.
I would just like to add the one point I think Lisa may have left out. If your goal is carbon, let's get an administration that's serious and put on a carbon tax and put on a whopping gasoline tax and let the market respond rather than toying with all these other alternatives. Sorry, that was an editorial statement. Deeply felt after 30 years of fighting these battles. Yes, sir.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consulting engineer. What effect will the newer distribution technologies such as SCADA and automatic meter reading and distribution automation have on the picture?
What was the last word, have on the grid?
The picture.
Oh, on the picture.
That's the next panel, isn't it?
Yeah. They're excellent things. We should have done them years ago. SCADA is basically a grid management, a terrific stuff. Intelligent meters, I don't know why we didn't start 25 years ago. It's a crime. We should have them everywhere, and we should have intelligent appliances so people can use offload power and so on. Unlike many other people, I don't think it'll lower electric demand. I think it'll raise it, but it's a good thing regardless.
Yeah. It's the march forward of our society towards more computerization and IT. It's hard to resist that tidal wave.
I would observe that the Federal Communications Committee has an energy staff now, and they've put out a notice requesting comment on smart grid and the kind of some of the questions you raise. So I think that means something. I'm not sure exactly what, but that the FCC is now a place you go for energy policy. So.
I think we had a question all the way in the back.
Hi, Jason Fordney. I'm a reporter with Platts. Question for Mr. Mansueti. You sort of were characterizing the interconnection-wide planning processes that are going on as kind of the last crack for the states to have, you know, final siting authority. What will you be looking for in these proposals that would cause DOE to say, okay, you got it right, and how would that interplay with the push that we have for more federal siting authority? In other words, would you say, they've got it right with these proposals, we don't need federal siting authority? How would that break down?
Well, I have a very simple answer. I'm a career employee. That's a question to be answered by the political appointees way above me after a year or two of those projects going forward.
So we asked our former colleague David Sandelow, who's now head of policy at DOE,
yes,
that question.
Yes.
I think we have time for one more question, maybe. If there are, yes, sir.
Bob Grow, Greater Washington Board of Trade, backing up with kind of a simple question is, how much of the conversation on expanding transmission lines is driven by the need to connect with the renewables? In other words, you need more power connecting to existing coal, nuclear, et cetera, but how much is driven by that conversation?
And the best possible view of it, which I still cling to, is in fact this is for the first time in my lifetime of being interested in electricity, we actually see a convergence of interest, as far as I can tell, between some powerful green interests and some fairly traditional utilities. Okay, we want to keep the grid lit. We want to make it economical. And, you know, if Charlie goes too far, he'll never get a carbon tax. That's been tried and failed. Okay, but if you have any kind of way of internalizing the costs that worry you, you do that. You do that at the nodes, and then let the grid carry the stuff. It'll actually ease the pain. I mean, my guess is that if some of you manage to get in your draconian carbon limits, and I know you want to, we'll see if you do. But if you do, the only way it'll be politically palatable is if we have a very efficient grid behind it to make it affordable.
I want to thank all the panelists. I thought for a very provocative panel. If I could ask everyone just to remain a few minutes before the break, I was going to call on David Girard, who from the Rockefeller Foundation, who had asked to make a few remarks about your new project. Do you still want to do that?
I'll be very brief, Charlie.
Yeah, just come on up.
5 minutes.
Yeah.
You want us here?
You want us here?
Stay there.
Thank you for giving me a 2-minute commercial. I've known Charlie for a long time. Actually, Peter Huber's last point was where we take off, which is that the foundation is starting an exploratory effort to see whether, given the new imperatives, global and national, on the electricity system and the power grid, and clearly you've heard a lot about that, which is not just climate mitigation, greenhouse gas mitigation, but also climate resilience, having an efficient, interconnected North American power grid that will also have to address questions of energy security as the transport sector becomes more and more electrified over time. So what we've started to do is to have a process by which we are having interviews with all the stakeholders. We are starting with the premise that we need a timely, authoritative, equitable, fair, transparent process that will involve all the stakeholders in this very complex business. We will not duck the hard questions. We will face them head on. We do start with the premise that, in fact, a modern, interconnected, secure, resilient power grid is in our economic interests, in our environmental interests, in our vulnerability interests, and also if we take energy security seriously in terms of petroleum gradually being drained out of the transport sector over the next several decades. So what we're doing is we're having a process by which we will interview up to about 50 stakeholders at the state, the federal, the local level, and involve the industry, and involve environmental groups. We want this to be credible, authoritative, independent. We will look at comprehensive transmission siting protocols, what are the best practices, best tools. We'll identify what the obstacles are, and tools and technologies to speed the process. So we'll be looking at siting, planning, and cost allocation, focusing very much on what some of the solution paths are, policy solutions, regulatory solutions, technological solutions, while accommodating legitimate community and environmental concerns. So our goal is not to be lobbyists, not to influence legislation, but to face the hard questions here and come up with solutions to some of the hard questions, both in terms of substance and in terms of processes that will give us timely results. And so what we'll do is, after the set of interviews, Meridian is helping us with this, as is the Energy Future Coalition. And we'll convene one or two meetings of all of the primary stakeholders after having done our homework along these lines. So I just wanted to let you know that. And so many of the folks here are going to, we will engage with, both in one-to-one discussions and hopefully in a larger convening, one or two larger convenings in the next few months. We'd like to get some answers in 6 months. I mean, there's no point in us getting in there and dragging this process on for 2 years. I mean, we'd like to come back to all of you with some answers, both about the process and the substance. And again, we will try to be as independent and authoritative and transparent as possible. Thanks, Charlie.